This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories for posterity, and along the way be educated and inspired as we hear what life was like way back then and how they endured one of the more turbulent times in world history. Today's going to be a little different, and I guess I need to explain it a little bit. I mentioned preserving their stories, and it's so satisfying for me to know that the families of the veterans you hear from on this show will always have their stories long after the veterans themselves are gone. I end up feeling a connection to each veteran who sits down with me, but the guy we're going to hear from today has been a really special friend in my life. Dr. Stan Lindquist just passed away at the age of 96. He lived a truly remarkable life, and we're going to explore that, but I want to give you a little background. I've been interviewing a World War II veteran a week for almost 9 years now. I started because of my grandfather, who was a decorated Army doctor in World War II and had never really said much about how he earned the Silver Star and the Bronze Star in Europe. I always think about him this time of year as I wonder just how awful, how freezing, how horrible it must have been for him and those thousands upon thousands like him involved in the Battle of the Bulge. He was one of the first vets that I talked to as part of a series on local television, and that series eventually led to this companion radio program, and it also led to a lot of invitations to go speak at different service clubs around Central California. So as a result, many years ago, I was speaking to a Rotary Club in downtown Fresno about World War II veterans and the idea of preserving their stories, and a guy named Brent Lindquist came up to me and introduced his father. He told me his dad had been wounded in the war and had spent a lot of time in foxholes overseas using a flashlight to write letters home, not just letters to his wife, but letters of encouragement for other servicemen published in his church newsletter. Sounded somewhat interesting, and he later gave me copies of some of those letters, and once I finally got around to reading them, I was absolutely blown away by the wisdom, the inspiration, the perspective that this young man had displayed in the midst of a war zone. I put together a television piece with Dr. Stan, and we're going to listen to a radio interview with him from 2007 when Hometown Heroes was just getting started. I'm guessing you probably didn't hear it at the time, and if by some chance you did, I don't think you're going to mind too much hearing it again all these years later. Right now, to just give you a taste here, let me read you one of these columns that then PFC Stanley Lindquist wrote in October 1944, and I'll let you be the judge of how prescient and how relevant it proved to be. This is before the Battle of the Bulge, more than 6 months before the eventual defeat of Germany, but he titled his entry in that newsletter, Hitler's Punishment. In response to a contest for a possible punishment for Hitler after the war, a young black girl who lived in a northern city submitted a rather unique plan. She suggested that Hitler be given black skin and made to live in the United States. She won the prize. This is, of course, a purely hypothetical answer, but is it possible that a member of a minority race in our country, the land where all are supposed to be free and equal politically, at least to an extent, can have a feeling that such a punishment might be considered for so great a despot? If this is the case, it behooves us to do some thinking about what we are fighting. To what extent is our country in the grips of intolerance to cause one to bring forth such an answer? Are the principles laid down by our ancestors carried that far from their intent? We are fighting a war to give minority races in other countries a chance to have their voice in government while our own problems are unsolved. Soldiers have an unequaled opportunity for detached thinking, and it's time that we begin thinking along some of these lines so that when we return, we will have some positive ideas on the subjects which will be put before us as citizens on which we vote. We can see in the foreign lands what racial prejudice and minority suppression has caused, and gain wherefrom a lesson. Religion gives us the most objective view on the subject and must be considered. Let us pray God that we will be prepared to lead our country in these perilous times which are going to come after this war, that we will follow His direction and guidance even in it. Signed, Private Buck. And isn't it amazing? That was written in 1944. We can look back with the lens of history now and know what has unfolded in our country. During World War II, of course, it was a segregated military. And what insight from a foxhole from Private Buck. That was the pseudonym of a then 27-year-old Stan Lindquist. And when I read those words and so many other similarly inspired columns, I told Stan and his son Brent, you guys need to publish this. They had printed some up for family after Brent had discovered them in the 90s. But for me, I could see just how powerful these letters from combat could be for members of our military today, and really for any of us. I certainly gobbled them all up myself in reading. So I told him, you've got to put this in a book and get it out there so people can read it. And little did I know that they would do that in a wonderful way with a great effort involving many members of their family. This interview that you're about to hear took place right after that book was published in 2007. Stan Lindquist had six older brothers and sisters. And because his father was a pastor starting churches here, there, and everywhere, Stan grew up in Texas, Nebraska, Washington, finally here in California. And while attending Fresno State, he met a young lady named Ingrid from Kingsburg. So Kingsburg, California is where he was when America was drawn into World War II. And that's where we're going to pick up the interview. You went into the service in 1943, right after the birth of your first son, Douglas. But you thought you were going to have to go in earlier than 1943. Uncle Sam cut you a little break, didn't he?
Right, sure did. I was all set. I was interviewing at the draft board. My number was very low. I think it was 76. And they wanted to know how I felt about going in. And I said, well, I obviously didn't feel good about it particularly, but I was ready. However, my wife was pregnant, and we had already lost one child at 3 months. And as her three-month period was going to be coming up in a couple of months, I asked if I could be deferred for 2 months at any rate. They instead said, no, it's really a perilous time up until it's finished. So they deferred me for 1 year, and I was real happy for that. So I went home to tell Ingrid, and she was really pleased, too.
I bet she was. And you were in Kingsburg at the time. Your father had been a preacher, a church planter all over the country. He started quite a few churches, including the one that you attend now in Fresno, known as The Bridge. And anyway, there you are in Kingsburg. Eventually, that deferment ran out. You got to be there for that important time with your wife, but Uncle Sam would not let that last forever. And finally, he said, I want you. They found out you had a little bit of experience as a food inspector with the Department of Agriculture. So what did the Army decide that made you qualified for?
Well, one of the things that I had done in between, I was teaching school ordinarily. During the summer, I decided to get another job and earn a little more money. And this was a inspecting the plants and the packaged foods, especially raisins and fruits of that sort, dried fruits. And so then in doing that, part of our job was to inspect the facilities and be sure that they were clean and checked on the operation of it to be sure that it wasn't any contamination. So then the captain happened to see that I had been doing that, and he thought, well, the captain of the medical corps, that is. And he said, I think we should have him to come with me, because when I inspect the kitchens, he'll have had some experience about inspecting. So that's how I got in the medical corps.
As if anything can really be sterile in a war zone.
That's the truth.
So long before you became Dr. Stan Lindquist, you became an Army medic. And I get a kick out of tidbits like this. They stuck you on a ship headed overseas, and there were more people on that ship than in the entire city of Kingsburg where you'd been living.
Oh, my, many, many, many times more. And we were on the Queen Elizabeth, which was taken as a troop ship, and in my cabin, there were eight or nine of us in a cabin that was supposed to keep just two people. We were in bunks and triple bunks and sleeping on the floor, and it was really quite an amazing operation. But we went relatively fast, and because we went fast, then we didn't have the same escort that other slower troop ships had, because we could outrun the submarines in case they ran into them. So that was an advantage in itself.
Now, obviously, you had no idea what to expect once you actually got there, but what was your mindset like? What was your outlook? Here you are leaving behind a wife and a young baby back in Kingsburg, heading halfway across the world into this European war zone. What was going through your mind at the time?
Oh boy, that's kind of hard to recall. To me, I felt it was kind of a hopeless situation, really. And I just decided that what I was going to do is just do the best I could and take what came, regardless of what it was. If it was difficult and fearful, fine. Well, then we'll do what we could do with that. If it was just ordinary kind of routine work, I'll do that. So I'd sort of resign myself just to exist, really, is what it amounted to.
At some point, it hits you, though. I'm in a war. This is real. This isn't a game. What was that moment for you when the stakes became clear? When did you realize this is the real thing?
Well, I think when I hit the troop ship, I realized that was the real thing, because now I was on the way over. There wasn't any more waiting time. We spent days and days on the train to get across country. And one thing that amazed me was that at every stop we made in the middle of the night or whenever it was, there was always people. And they had coffee and donuts and things of this, cookies, all homemade for us. And how they ever figured out that we were coming through is more than I could figure out. But it was sort of a nice treat anyway.
Yeah, I would imagine so. Dr. Stan Lindquist, founder of the Link Care Center and author of Letters from Private Buck, Devotionals from World War II Combat. Those letters are an interesting story in themselves. Your son Brent, with whom you're very close for years and years, he had no idea that you had written these letters during the war. And there's dozens and dozens of these letters with inspirational messages. You sent them back home to your wife Ingrid while you're overseas, and she would pass them on to get published on this special section for servicemen in the Evangelical Beacon, the official magazine or newsletter of your denomination. And they went everywhere. I don't want to give everything away just yet, but Brent doesn't find out about any of this till more than 50 years later. This whole story is amazing. But while we're on the topic of these letters, this Private Buck column, as some may have experienced it then, why did you decide to start writing these letters? Was it for your own personal spiritual growth, or did you feel a call to encourage others? What was the genesis for that decision?
Well, really, I was sort of requested to do it by the editor of our paper, the editor of the servicemen's page. Then I thought, well, that would be a great chance for me to at least interact with other people, and hopefully my experiences and my faith, which I had in God, could be transferred and helped the other folks too, in case they didn't have that faith, and help them to learn how to deal with situations that were life-threatening in a way that was more positive and helpful. So I suppose that would be the motivation to do it.
Well, I'm sure that it did touch many people then. I know that I've been blessed in reading through it all these years later and really amazed at how relevant all your observations and sentiments are for our world today. When I first read them, they were in a spiral-bound notebook copied from the originals, but Dr. Stan and his son Brent worked very hard to get them typed up, add a little new content, and put it together in the paperback book, Letters from Private Buck, Devotionals from World War II Combat. This is all from a Christian perspective, but I really think there's value here for you regardless of whether you're a Christian, wherever your faith or what your faith is. You get inside the mind of somebody on the ground in combat situations during World War II, and you see some of the things that he saw and get his perspective on what was happening around him and how that would impact the future. I'm going to read you a little excerpt. I realize chronologically we might end up a little back and forth this time, but this is a really striking entry, again in a column penned at the time under the pseudonym Private Buck. This one is actually from after the war had come to an end, and it gives you a real picture of what people are dealing with in the wake of war and what was on Stan Lindquist's heart as he wrote from his perspective of faith. Dated September 11th, 1945, came with the headline, More on Peace, and it reads, On VJ Day, a man offered up a prayer in which he expressed thanks that with the war over, we, quote, could return again to normal living. I thought of George. He would never return. His beloved family would never be the same without him. Return again to normal living? Hank, blind because of a mine explosion, was destined to live a life of darkness, getting used to living in a media where his only guide would be the arm of a friend, the tug of a devoted dog, the tapping of a cane. Return to normal life? Hal, his face completely disfigured so that one could hardly determine what were his features as a result of a plane crash. Return to normal living? Mac, who lost a leg in the Battle of the Bulge. To return to any kind of normal living would be a matter of constant adjustment and hardship. Return to normal living? Those of us who were not blighted in quite that way, but who have given a portion of our lives to our country's preservation, and who, because of horrible experiences, can never be the same, can we return to normal life? My heart cries, no, there can be no return to normal living. There must be a return to living in a way which justifies the time spent and the work done, which can be justified to those who gave their lives to keep our country in the way it should be, which can in some measure help those who are permanently maimed. What way can be better than to purpose anew in our hearts that we shall serve God as never before, we shall live so that others can see that Christ means more than an easy road to keep from going to hell, we shall devote that portion of our life which God says to spend in His service anew to the great ideal of walking in His steps. Again, signed, Private Buck. Those are words written nearly 70 years ago by Dr. Stanley Lindquist, revisiting this interview in the wake of his death at the age of 96. What an incredible impact he had in the areas that really mattered to him. And those descriptions of veterans in the different states in which they returned from war or even didn't return from war, that wasn't just hypothetical. We're going to hear about how Dr. Lindquist himself earned the Purple Heart when we come back. If you'd like to get a copy of this book, Letters from Private Buck, I have the information on our Hometown Heroes Facebook page, or you can call the Link Care Center, Dr. Stan's lasting legacy. We're going to tell you more about that later. But the number for the Link Care Center in Fresno is 559-439-5920. That's 559-439-5920. And I'll be back with more of Hometown Heroes right after this.
They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up, and I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just gotta go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, looking back at the life of Dr. Stan Lindquist. I spoke to him in my early days of interviewing veterans, and many of you have not heard his story. With his passing, I couldn't miss the opportunity to share a little bit of his legacy with you. We're going to pick up the interview now with a focus on his personal experiences in Europe during World War II. Tell me some of the things you saw early on, because you were an Army medic. You're on the front lines. You're tending to guys who've been shot, who've been blown up, guys who have been killed in combat, some who are almost dead. How did you handle that? Tell us some of the things that you saw and what got you through it from day to day, because I can't imagine how difficult that must have been.
Well, there are so many times that things have happened that have created problems that were problems too. After a while, you get a little bit used to that. You never get really used to it, but at least it doesn't hit you the same way as it did the first time. And I remember one time when I was out, I was always an early bird, and I always got up before most of the other soldiers did for some reason, and I guess my farm home living started me that way. I guess that's all the only reason I can expect to express it. Anyway, and I was walking around and I saw a lot of slit trenches, trenches that were flat. They weren't very deep, but they were long, so we could lie down in them. And then you piled dirt in front of you so that hopefully if the shots were coming, they'd go over you. And in this one slit trench was a soldier, and he was absolutely still, and I didn't know whether he was awake or what, and so I shook his shoulder and discovered that he was dead. And all he had on his wound was a little nick in his steel helmet, where a piece of shrapnel had come from above and penetrated his brain and killed him immediately. And his buddies had to move on for their job, obviously, and they left him there. The grave detail hadn't showed up yet. But that really struck me real hard, because here we were doing things that we were told that would save us, protect us, and here he had done everything right, but it didn't work out. And so I began to see, you know, how does this work in with God's plan for our life? And I think that it began to reinforce my feeling that, well, I'm either going to get it or I'm not. And I might as well just go ahead and do the best I can and try what I could. Now, this really became important for me at one time when we were bombed by our own planes. And they hit our ammunition bump. The reason was that we were so far ahead of the where the battle lines were supposed to be. I guess the pilot must have thought we were German troops. I don't know how he could get us mixed up with that, but because our vehicles were different. Or maybe he was just unloading his bombs because he didn't want to go back with them on. And at any rate, he bombed us on the hill, and it happened to be our ammunition dump. And it just created hell on earth. And I was told, hey, go in there and see if there are any guys living and see if you can't pull them out. And I don't know, the shots were coming from every direction. It's much worse than if they're aimed, because you don't know where they're going. And then the big shells would blast every once in a while, and powder kegs would burn and all. It was just a horrible mess. Well, anyway, we picked our way through it, and we got burned a little bit. I had asked one of the fellows there to take the other end of the stretcher in case we found somebody. And I remember one fellow especially, the first one I came to, I thought, well, I'm going to get him on this stretcher and then we can get out quick. That'd be a way to get through this. But I took hold of his hand and the flesh, I mean his arm, and the flesh just pulled up. He was just totally cooked. It was just really a shocking thing. But we went through, and there were a lot of men sitting in their trucks. It was the ammunition trucks. They looked as if they were alive, but they were all dead. They were all absolutely burned up, or smoke inhalation had killed them or something. And finally, we had a chance then to turn around, and we threw the stretcher down and took off. And the way we couldn't go back the way we came, because it was all burning, we couldn't get through. So we finally found a way and got behind some rocks where we protected a little bit, and we managed to get out. And I really felt that somehow God was with me and us, that we were able to get through that and be able to do it in the first place, because that was a scary situation to get into.
You know, I talked to so many veterans who say that those kind of images stick with them. Is that something that you've tried to get out of your head and can't? Or have you found a way to compartmentalize or deal with it?
I have written about this, so that in fact, one of the appendices in the book is this particular story. I think that helps a lot. But also the fact that you know, if you feel that God is with you and he has protected you, that gives you some sort of reassurance that goes beyond. And every time you remember it, it just, you hopefully say, well, thank goodness for that, or thank God for that. Only one time was I really had a bad case of reintegration, that's sometimes called. We were living in Chicago. I was going to the university there, the University of Chicago, and we decided to sleep out on a kind of a sleeping porch. with windows all the way around, but it was up high. And there was a very severe storm, as they happened in Chicago. And I woke up thinking I was back in the battlefield, and I practically ran out of the place. And I realized that, no, I'm not there. This is a safe place for me to be. And my wife was sleeping alongside me, and my son was in his crib right next to us. And they were all okay. And so I said, well, to myself, I said, it's okay.
Yeah, like you said, thank the Lord for that. And speaking of things you're thankful for surviving. I want to ask you about an experience that I guess you could say was the critical point of your service during the war and really set the course for the rest of your life in a roundabout way, certainly not the way that you planned it. There's a saying I hear from a lot of veterans, whether they're Army, Navy, Marines, you name it. They say, never volunteer for anything. And you made that mistake, didn't you?
Sure did. And that's what ended my war experience, that particular incident. It wasn't nearly as scary as the incident I've just described. It was just a plain field with the cows were grazing on the field, and it looked like it was a perfectly quiet place. But in the middle of the field were a couple of GIs, and they were blown up. This was a minefield. And the whole thing was mined because there was a gap in the Hurtgen Forest, and they wanted to stop the equipment from going through there, so it was mined. Well, I don't know why we did this, really, but I think we felt that we should go ahead and try to save those kids that were there.
Especially as a medic, that was one of your duties, to tend to the wounded. And here they are wounded in the middle of a minefield, a clearing in Germany's Hurtgen Forest. And you and your friend, another young medic, you volunteer to go into the minefield, get these injured soldiers, and bring them back.
Right. Well, anyway, we stood there, and I really wondered, you know, this seems kind of a stupid thing to do. And I really was... My knees were pretty shaky, but somehow it seemed to me that, as I remembered a verse from the scriptures, that giving your life for another person is a great thing to do.
Greater love hath no man.
Right.
Lay down his life for his friend.
Right, exactly the thing. And that seemed to give me some strength. We decided then that we would go. The fellow with me was just a young man. He just got out of college. So he was quite a bit younger than I. I was an old man. I'd graduated from college for some time. Had worked for a couple of years at teaching school. But we went on out, and we were able to find a way by looking where the ground had been disturbed. We could tell where they'd hidden the mines, the anti-personnel mines. That was the ones that are hard. The big mines, we could avoid them because we could step on them and it wouldn't make any difference anyway. But then we got out about 100 yards or maybe more. Suddenly we couldn't find a way. And so we came together. Normally we always stayed at least 20 feet apart so that if one got blown up, then the other one could help out. Well, in this case, we were trying to decide what to do. And so we figured it out, and I said, I think we could go right this way. And the young man, Herschel McGee, his name was, afterwards he said he moved his foot a quarter of an inch or a half an inch or whatever. Anyway, a short distance, he blew up a mine. And that set off three different mines. One directly under him, which blew off part of his foot. Another one a little further away was the one that shattered my feet and my ankles and leg. And the one that he set off blew up into my face, so it had locked one of my eyes, hit out one of the eyes, and I was picking shrapnel out of my face for years afterwards, it seemed like. But anyway, we both got blown up into the air. In just a second, our service time was over. So then from that on, I had to spend about 9 months in the hospital. I couldn't walk or anything.
And you couldn't see. You lost your right eye, and you couldn't see out of your left eye either. For how long?
Oh, about 3-4 weeks, as I remember it. You know, it might, sometimes things are a little foggy, but as I remember it, that's about how long it was.
What was the first thing you remember after the mines blew up? What was the next moment of consciousness for you?
Well, the next time was when we were going to the hospital in the ambulance, which was really an old truck that had been fixed up with some beds in it. Stretchers wasn't mounted to.
Did you know what had happened to you, or did they have to explain it to you?
I knew that something had happened bad, and I knew that I couldn't walk because I couldn't move my legs. I think I could move them a little bit, but I couldn't stand on them. And when Hirsch had called for a tourniquet, I was able to find a tourniquet out of my aid kit and threw it to him. So I was awake to that extent, and I also knew that it was going to be awful painful, although it wasn't then. So I got out a shot for deadening the pain, and I squeezed it, jabbed it in my leg and squeezed it, and it wouldn't go out, and then finally it just broke and dribbled all over my hand because I'd forgotten to puncture it to begin with.
And you're doing all of this blind.
Yeah, without seeing anything. And anyway, I was trying my best to do something, and then I passed out, I guess, because I don't remember much at all from there on until we got in an ambulance, and that was a horrible experience. It was a rough riding thing. I tell you, they didn't have very good springs on those things.
Yikes. I'm sure you at home are imagining yourself in his position, wounded, blinded, and completely unsure of the future. But there was quite a future in store for Dr. Stan Lindquist, and we'll get to that and the remarkable legacy he has left us when Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch right after this.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkernCounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, the show that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, men and women who've done remarkable things for the sake of our freedom. Recording the stories of our veterans gives us the chance to hear those tales even after they're gone. And that's what we're doing today after the death of Dr. Stan Lindquist, who gave his eye and part of his leg for our country as a World War II medic in Europe. This interview was recorded 6 years ago when he was 90 and had just published a book of inspirational letters he had penned for fellow servicemen during the war. When we left off, he'd described volunteering to go into a minefield and rescue wounded soldiers only to be blown into the air when a grouping of mines detonated. Dr. Stan lost his right eye. He couldn't see anything out of his left eye, had extensive damage to his lower body as well. So I asked him, did you think at that point that you would ever walk again, that you would ever see again? You had a wife and a baby boy back home. What in the world was going through your mind?
Well, I really didn't realize how badly injured I was. Because my legs didn't show an awful lot, you know. I mean, I didn't have any blown off like Herschel did. Mine just looked sort of normal. They looked a little bruised and misshapen, but as far as that was concerned, I had no idea. In fact, I was really afraid that I was going to get well and had to come back again.
That would not be an issue for you.
It wasn't. But at any rate, so when we got to the field hospital, then they bandaged the one eye. Evidently, they put some stitches in my left eye. And the right eye, they said, well, it's impossible anyway. You may never see in that one. And they were right, because I never could see anything with that eye. So eventually they had to take it out. But so now I have a plastic eye, which functions so well that some people don't know me for years and don't even know I have a plastic eye.
Until you pop it out and wash it in your sink. Your son Brent tells a great story about that. And the first time he saw you cleaning it off in that manner. Not everybody's dad can perform that trick. And one of the things that really struck me when I was reading through all these Private Buck letters before you had them in book form, you actually wrote several additional installments, extra copies of that column ahead of time before you were injured, just in case you were injured. So they're publishing all of these. They've never revealed your real name. It's always just Private Buck. And then you're injured. And on March 20th, 1945, there's an entry with the headline, Private Buck Wounded. It has your picture there, and I'm going to read it. It says, Editor's note, every reader of this page will be saddened to hear that Private Buck, one of our Free Church boys who has been writing down his thoughts as he moved from camp to camp and overseas spot to overseas spot, has been wounded. To uncover his alias, Private Buck is Private Stanley E. Lindquist of the Kingsburg, California Free Church and son of Reverend E. H. Lindquist, superintendent of the Western District. Stan was wounded in Germany while attempting to rescue two of his buddies who had been hit by a mine. He was wounded himself, but together with his buddies managed to get the other fellows out. Right now he is in a hospital in England and, according to his latest letter, might lose his right eye and his right leg. But he is still cheerful and eager to serve the Lord. He has promised to keep on writing for you after he gets to feeling better. He had just completed a series before being wounded, so these will be running the next few issues. Pray for him, will you? And there's no doubt so many must have honored that request. They were praying for you. And these letters you'd written ahead of time are running while you recuperate. Then you start writing again after that. You end up touring the country, going to all these churches all over the place, trying to raise money for Gold Star Memorial Funds to honor those who gave their lives in the service during World War II. This sounds like a crazy whirlwind period in your life. And here you still have a family at home, too. What was your sense at that point in terms of what was in store for you? What did you think your future might hold at that point?
I really didn't know. I applied for admission to the University of Chicago Psychology Department in the graduate school, which was in the biological sciences. And I didn't know it then, but I was admitted. But later I found out that there were about 2,000 others that had applied, and 16 were accepted, and I was one of the 16. And that had to be God's intervention, because there was no way I could have gotten in there any other way.
Well, you did have quite a bit of experience at beating the odds already.
Yeah, that's true. So that I was just, you know, trying to get ready, and I wasn't really aware of what I was getting ready for. All I knew was that I couldn't go back to any of my old jobs. I was absolutely kind of devastated when I sat in the hospital one day and said, what am I going to be doing with my life? Because I can't walk much, and I can't do anything that I did before. I couldn't farm like I did a little bit. I couldn't teach. I couldn't be inspector because you had to walk so much, and I couldn't do that. So I was really up against it, as many servicemen are even now. They say, where are we going to go? But I took advantage of taking an inventory of my life and what's been going on, and I realized that I had something that was irreplaceable, and that was God. And I felt he was guiding me and directing me. I didn't know how, but somehow he was.
Well, and you would eventually become part of the psychology faculty at Fresno State. At one point in the 1960s, you decided you're going to branch out and do something on your own. And out of your home initially, you started ministering to missionaries. You had been on the battlefield. They're out in this mission field, and you realized how vulnerable that they could be, that they go through a lot of things. Their faith is shaken at times. They can be in need of counseling and care for their mental health. At that point, I know you did not know what it would turn into. You had no idea the magnitude of it. But what was your original idea? Why did you think that this idea that really no one else was pursuing was your calling?
Well, I think that it came directly from them, because they asked for it. You know, they said, what can we do? How can we reorient our lives, because we have these problems? And of course, with my background that I was gradually learning in the field of psychology, I thought, you know, this is really what God's prepared me for, huh? Maybe that's it. So that after, it was 7 years after I graduated and I moved to Fresno State, I was teaching at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School and this college at the same time. And the missionaries came to me there. And then when I left there and went to Fresno State, I started a part-time private practice after a while. I asked the president, you know, about that. He said, you're allowed to do a certain amount of time, but you can't have it take over your life.
Little did he know.
You know, 10, 12 hours a week is about the limit. And so when the missionaries came, I thought, well, now maybe this is the area I should specialize in. And they really were the ones that pushed me into it. And I had no idea what was going to happen or how it was going to grow. And I have no idea that, you know, right now, we've had over 8,000 family members and people in our program who have been living on our campus. Our campus, we have 104 apartments, and some of them are completely refurnished, so the missionary can come just with their suitcase and take care of themselves get the help they need.
Yes, the Link Care Center really is the gold standard in its field. It is the largest organization of its kind, providing counseling and support for missionaries and pastors who end up in Fresno from all over the globe. The Link Care Center provides community counseling, too, for anybody in the area. You don't have to be a pastor or a missionary. And all of this grew out of what you started in your house, just trying to help a few missionaries and encourage them. Obviously, you had no idea this would turn into what it is today.
No, I'm just, every time I drive down to the place, I think, what has God wrought? You know what?
Samuel F. B. Morse.
Yeah. Right. So, because obviously it couldn't be one person be able to do this, because unless God was in it, it wouldn't happen. And because he's in it, then it does happen. And so then I was able to get recruit some help from a lot of other folks gradually. It was hard at the beginning because psychology was considered by some strong Christians as being sort of the work of the devil, because it's working with your mind or something. I'm not sure what they'd be thinking, but something like that. And there weren't too many people who, first of all, who had the qualifications that we needed, because we had to have proper degrees, PhD preferably, and master's degrees, and with the ability to get a license.
Mm-hmm.
Because getting a license was important to get the insurance, and most of the missionaries had insurance, and that's really what's keeping us going. Very, very few people are willing to contribute much to this. We think, you know, God should take care of them without having anybody any man getting involved in it. So that's the attitude. It's expressed sometimes, but mostly it's not expressed. But at any rate, so that's really the most fantastic thing that's ever happened to me.
Well, it has had an impact on so many lives directly, and no doubt incrementally more indirectly. And none of this would have happened. Two more sons would have never been born, not to mention so many grandkids and great-grandkids, if you hadn't survived that minefield incident. And so much of that story is captured in the book, Letters from Private Buck. Now, in putting this in book form, you've added a few things that weren't in those columns that you wrote during the war. They add a little context to everything and share a little perspective that you developed over the years since. What are some of those extra things that we'll find in Letters from Private Buck?
One of the things that happens when you're writing from the front is that there's a censor that gets involved, and he takes out anything that might relate to what's going on, which is part of his job.
Sure.
So you couldn't say much about where you were. So now I went back, and first of all, I had to set up an introduction so we could set up the setting for the whole thing. And then I put on, in addition to that, some places where a little explanation seemed to be helpful to just carry the story along, as well as the article letters, so that gave me an opportunity to just fill out the details. And then the appendices, I have a couple of those, which tells both the experience that I had, which I've discussed briefly, as well as the final injury that ended the war for me, because those parts, of course, had to be written afterwards, and some of them have been updated, and you know, so that parts of it are relatively recent, but the most of it is, as you said, 60 years old.
And I'm sure that when you were blown up, in your words, in that German minefield, blown up into the air, losing your right eye, losing part of your leg, you didn't think you were going to see your 90th birthday, let alone be publishing a book at age 90. But here you are today. I do want to ask you, though, about those injuries. What are the lingering effects of what happened to you in the Hürtgen Forest all those years ago?
Well, of course, having only one eye changes my perspective totally, and I'll reach out for something and I'll be off it a little bit. Reaching for a glass, sometimes I'll hit the middle of it and knock the glass over instead of picking it up. That's one of the things. And the other thing is, as far as my walking is concerned, of course, I'm somewhat unstable, and especially in walking longer distances, I get to a point I can't walk at all, and my legs hurt all the time, very badly. So that is the main thing that I have to compete with or deal with at the present time.
And with all that said, I have a feeling that I know what your answer is going to be. If I ask you, would you change anything that happened to you while you were serving our country?
Well, I don't think I can, and I won't. Because if I were doing it over again, maybe I'd be a little more enthusiastic about some aspects of it. That's always a possibility. But my wife used to say, don't you wish you could live your life over again? And I said, oh, my goodness, I'm not sure.
You're pretty thankful for the way it's all worked out, aren't you?
It worked out according to God's plan, maybe not all to mine, and went way beyond mine, my views or whatever. So that certainly is true, yes.
Well, I'm certainly thankful for the privilege of knowing you and seeing this latest chapter in your story unfold. We're getting short on time, but is there anything else about your service during World War II that you'd like us to know?
Well, one of the things I think that we all feel is that somehow we're very fortunate to live in a country like we do. And if we have anything that we can do to do something about it, well, that's something that we ought to do. I sometimes think that our task has been overblown. You know, I get the feeling that, you know, so you have things the way you have them is because of what we did, but I'm not sure that I feel that way.
What a humble guy, huh? If you weigh the impact that Dr. Stan Lindquist had it really is almost impossible to calculate because it crosses continents, it crosses generations. That's why CBMC Fresno recently started a Dr. Stan Lindquist Impact Award in his honor. The book we talked about today is available online, and I have that info on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. If you're thinking it would make a good Christmas gift for a veteran or for anybody else in your life and you want to get the book in time for the holidays, you can call the Link Care Center at 559-439-5920. That's 559-439-5920. And speaking of the Link Care Center, not only does it offer counseling to missionaries and pastoral staff, one of the newer programs there is specifically for veterans, focusing especially on those who've just come home from deployments and would like to receive counseling from a Christian perspective. A scholarship program has been set up, so cost will never be an issue for veterans in need of counseling. Just another reflection of Dr. Stan Lindquist's legacy, and I know he was very proud of that latest addition to what Link Care does. We can look at his Purple Heart, we can read his book, and I hope you will, but the Link Care Center and the lives it's touched over nearly a half century now is the most powerful indication of just how special this World War II veteran was and what we'd all be missing out on if he hadn't survived all those years ago. I hope you've enjoyed this retrospective as much as I have. Next week, we're going to be back with a veteran who is still with us. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.